Good afternoon. It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from Signal Hill here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is a wet and sloppy 36 degrees, and we're looking for more snow today. High near 38, northwest wind to 15 miles per hour. Could increase to 20 miles per hour this afternoon, and gust as high as 30 miles per hour. Our chance of precipitation, 100% for the rest of the day. But they're talking about less than a half inch of whatever this is accumulating on the ground. For tonight, isolated snow showers between midnight and 3 a.m. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 32. West wind is expected to increase to 30 miles per hour after midnight and could gust as high as 40. Coming up on the midday news, a summary of yesterday's Scandi's Rose hearing. President Biden's pick for Interior Secretary Deb Haaland began her confirmation hearing in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, chaired by Senator Murkowski. And the case count grows for the Petersburg outbreak of COVID-19.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Sang. The FDA could be days away from authorizing a third COVID-19 vaccine, the one-dose shot from Johnson & Johnson, for emergency use. An advisory panel will review J&J data this Friday. Meanwhile, an NIH panel's upgraded its recommendation for the use of monoclonal antibodies to treat mild to moderate COVID-19. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
The Food and Drug Administration has granted emergency use to monoclonal antibody treatments. These are designed to help keep people with mild to moderate COVID-19 out of the hospital. But expert panels have said there's not enough solid evidence to show if they are truly effective. That's now changed. The NIH's COVID treatment guidelines panel now recommends the use of a combination therapy produced by Eli Lilly, particularly for people at high risk of serious illness. The panel is prepared to review additional data from another monoclonal antibody combination from the drug company Regeneron. But for now, the Eli Lilly product is the only one that gets a solid thumbs up from this expert panel. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Tens of thousands of Texans who are among the millions to brave last week's unprecedented extreme cold without electricity or water now face steep home repair costs. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Travall has more.
State Farm, the state's largest insurer, says Texans have filed some 37,000 claims so far relating to home damage caused by the winter weather. That's almost 10 times the number of frozen and burst water pipe claims State Farm dealt with nationally last year. State Farm spokesperson Chris Pilsick says this catastrophic event was very widespread.
These claims are coming in really from all areas of the state. Higher concentrations in Houston. I would say a lot of our claims are coming in from Harris and Fort Bend County and the Houston Metro, but also Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas.
Last year, individual burst pipes claims in Texas averaged $10,000. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
After battling his way back from years of personal turmoil, golfer Tiger Woods could be facing his most difficult comeback yet. He's in the hospital recovering from surgery for serious injuries he sustained in a major car crash outside Los Angeles yesterday that police say he was lucky to survive. NPR's Tom Goldman reports a legendary golfer is no stranger to major setbacks.
We've seen him come back from so much, not just medical situations, but scandal, of course, that began in 2009. But at a fifth back surgery, remember, he had a spinal fusion a few years back and wasn't sure how that was going to pan out. It worked for a time, and it allowed him to win his 15th major tournament, the Masters, in 2019.
NPR's Tom Goldman reporting. Police say there's no evidence that Woods was impaired when he was driving. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed up 424 points, 1.3%, ending at 31,962. This is NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
President Biden's pick for Interior Secretary began her confirmation hearing in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee on yesterday morning. For Senator Lisa Murkowski, the nomination presents a dilemma. Alaskan Native leaders have mounted a big campaign to confirm Holland. The Interior Department has enormous sway over Alaskan Native interests. Holland is a Laguna Pueblo tribal member from New Mexico. She'd be the first indigenous cabinet secretary. Former Alaska legislator Mary Patella of Bethel says Holland's background matters because the authority she would have over subsistence hunting and fishing rights, tribal courts, and Native allotments.
For hundreds of years, we really haven't had many Native people at the top who have a true understanding of the way that we live and our values and, you know, just the realities of growing up as a Native person and raising your family as a Native person. This is a very big deal.
But Holland has been an outspoken opponent of oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Selling drilling rights in the refuge is one of Murkowski's biggest achievements. At the hearing, Murkowski acknowledged how significant it would have been to have it would be to have a Native American lead Interior. She didn't directly confront Holland's environmental stance. Instead, Murkowski focused on Biden's first executive orders, which included a pause on leasing in the refuge.
From Alaska's perspective, you've got to understand that they're looking at this and saying, wait a minute, why is this administration out to get us? Well, I don't think they're out to get us, but I do think that there is a definite threat to the resource industry that our state is blessed to be able to host.
Holland began her response to Murkowski by reaching for common ground.
Senator, thank you so much. And if I could just quickly say thank you again for all of your help with the missing and murdered Indigenous women legislation. That means the world to me.
Holland said she'd consult with Murkowski on Alaska development issues and would follow the law. Alaska Congressman Don Young urged senators to confirm her. He introduced Holland at the start of the hearing. He described her as someone who will listen to Republicans and moderate her perspective to serve everyone.
So I want this secretary, as she's confirmed, I hope you do confirm her, understand there's a broad picture here. And her job, as I understand, is no longer a little cartoon. This is the big picture. And she'll have to have the responsibility to do the job I know she can do.
Holland's hearing continues today, and Murkowski told a reporter she has a lot more questions for her. The third day of the Scandies Rose hearing shed some light on stability issues that may have a more pronounced impact on the crab pot fishing fleet as a whole. Paul Zankich, Bud Bronson, and Jonathan Parrott are three expert naval architects who provided testimony this morning. They conduct stability reports on many vessels like the Scandies Rose. A major point they emphasized during their testimony is that stability reports for icing, that is, when ice forms on a vessel and its contents, may not be up to par. They said their calculations imagine ice forming on a surface area of a rack of crab pots, not the interior of the pots themselves. According to the Coast Guard panel, there has been one recent study on ice accumulation inside of crab pots. The study looked at only one pot using fresh water in Arctic conditions. There has never been an icing study on a stacked mass of pots on the deck of a fishing vessel. They said this could mean that the tremendous weight of ice forming on the deck of the Scandies Rose and other boats may not be fully accounted for in stability reports. Zankich went on to say that, quote, I, as a naval architect, do not believe in the regulations, unquote, referring to the regulations that determine what is considered safe levels of ice. He also alluded to his belief that the Scandies Rose rolled over due to ice buildup. The hearing went to recess, and after lunch we'll return to hear testimony from John Lawler, a survivor of the tragedy. The case count is climbing for a COVID-19 outbreak in Petersburg this week, as local health officials ask the community to take steps to slow the spread. Petersburg changed to high-risk red status on Monday following a spike in cases over the weekend. Many businesses, tribal, and government services are either suspended or switching to phone service only. The school district switched to remote learning yesterday. The overall case count is going up daily. It was up to 30 cases as of Tuesday afternoon. Petersburg's incident commander, Carl Hagerman, says community spread appears to be happening in multiple settings and locations.
It's very concerning, not only that it's occurring at all, but that we can't really pin it down to a certain one source. It just, to me, it elevates the concern level quite a bit and should impart to everybody that we just need to contract our circles right now and do the best we can to not be around others and try to knock this out.
Those case numbers may increase as the week goes on. It's been busy for the Petersburg Medical Center's hotline for people asking about being tested. PMC Chief of Staff Dr. Jennifer Heyer says that many who are diagnosed and calling to be tested are showing symptoms.
We have hospitalized two people who thankfully I can say we were able to treat successfully with the therapies that we have, which include IV antivirals, steroids, supplemental oxygen, and other therapies. So that's a definite success.
PMC has seen some COVID positives for people who have received the first of two doses of the vaccine, but none in people who have been fully vaccinated. The medical center plans to expand its free asymptomatic testing at the screening tent in Petersburg Airport starting today, so people without symptoms can be tested there as well. Alaska's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ann Zink, encouraged vaccination and testing.
What we learn again and again through this pandemic is that prevention is key. And so when we're able to identify cases early, people do much better, communities do much better. If you don't have COVID circulating, it's a lot easier to get together because you can't give COVID if you don't have it. So we really are encouraging people to test regularly. So it's great to hear about the asymptomatic testing. We have a lot of testing resources at the state and stand by to support you in any way we possibly can.
Meanwhile, the Borough Assembly Tuesday approved updated versions on local health mandates in response to the expiration of the state's disaster declaration. Those mandates cover traveler testing for people coming to Petersburg, cruise ships docking in the harbor, plans for companies bringing workers in from out of state, and a directive to provide temporary shelter for someone without a home who needs to isolate or quarantine. Community members continue to push back on those health measures, recommendations for vaccination, and Petersburg's unenforced mandate for masking. At an assembly meeting Monday night, local resident Donna Marsh asked the assembly to change directions.
The coronavirus, in all its variations, and it's been around a long time, is here to stay. People will get it, people may die from it, and most people survive very well after having acquired it. I would urge the council, the EOC, and those who are making decisions for the residents of Petersburg to let life continue. People thrive in having the opportunity to decide for themselves what they want to do, where they will travel, to whom they will, where they will spend their money, and the whole bit.
That same night, Assembly Member Chelsea Tremblay called for a better tone in the community discussion and said that everyone was tired of the pandemic.
But we don't get to abdicate our responsibilities to this community because we are tired of the weight that they put on us. So we are all very tired of this. I understand people are frustrated, and people are getting information from a lot of different places right now that send them a lot of different directions. But overall, I just want to thank everybody who's doing work to keep each other safe and following the steps that we all know by heart by now.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is working to finalize its sale of its fast ferries to an overseas bidder. Trasmapi, a Mediterranean-based operator of catamarans, offered about $4.6 million for the Fairweather and the Chiniga, but that was less than half of the $10 million reserve price set by the state. At the time bids were opened in January, a state procurement officer noted that a lower price could still be negotiated. John Falvey, general manager of the state-run ferry system, told a Senate committee on Tuesday that negotiations are progressing with an international firm.
We do have a responsive bidder, and we are continuing, as we speak today, to work through the process to close the sale.
Trasmapi runs ferries between the Spanish mainland and Ibiza. The Spanish company had also offered about $411,000 for a pair of diesel engines that had cost about $3 million new.
The two swing engines, which are in our warehouse in hermetically sealed containers, unused, they were also part of the sale.
The state of Alaska had commissioned the fast ferries in the mid-2000s, and they were popular, completing a voyage in about half the time as a conventional ship, but they were taken out of service in 2015 and 2019. At the time, the Marine Highway cited rising fuel costs and poor performance in rough seas. It's not clear how much the state is now asking for them. They cost $68 million brand new. When Pebble's federal permit proposal was rejected last year, several of Bristol-based tribal and regional entities renewed calls for permanent protections at the region's headwaters. Earlier this month, those groups introduced a two-step plan, or the call, to do just that. KDLG's Tyler Thompson has more.
The United Tribes of Bristol Bay published the call in December after the Army Corps of Engineers denied Northern Dynasty's permit application for the proposed Pebble Mine. At a virtual town hall earlier this month, UTBB presented a roadmap for the two-part plan. Here's Deputy Director Lindsay Leyland.
Tribes in the region and Bristol Bay leadership have come together once again to revive their previous request for 404C action. And we put a proposal forward for both administrative and legislative action to permanently protect Bristol Bay.
404C is a section of the Clean Water Act that restricts dumping dredged waste in defined waters or wetlands. Tribes in the region called for that veto over 10 years ago when Pebble was first proposed. In 2014, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed a preemptive veto of a larger mine in the area under Section 404C, but it was never finalized and the Trump administration withdrew the proposal. Renewing the veto process could prevent Pebble and future companies from dredging at Bristol Bay's headwaters. The Native American Rights Fund supports the region's call. Attorney Matt Newman says the second step of the plan could solidify permanent federal protections for the watershed.
Proposing and seeking out legislation that will offer similar kinds of protections from hard rock mining through the creation of a national fisheries area.
A national fisheries area in Bristol Bay would be the first of its kind. Through this designation, the groups supporting the plan want to ban any large-scale mines from waste disposal in Bristol Bay's waters. A focus on water protections would bypass the need for any state designation. Newman is looking to federal water protections for fish habitat in other parts of the country for guidance.
It is something that is uniquely suited for a very unique problem, mining in Bristol Bay. We are hopeful that by threading this needle very carefully, we can achieve the protection of Bristol Bay and its fisheries resources, but without land statuses like a park or a preserve that many local people don't necessarily want to see in the region.
The potential for federal protections in the region could happen under the Biden administration. President Joe Biden signed an executive order at the end of January proposing a plan to conserve 30% of land and water in the U.S. by 2030, known as the 30 by 30 executive order. The Department of Interior named tribes and fishers as some of the key stakeholders. Tyson Fick is a commercial fisher who works for Salmon State, a conservation group based in Juneau. Fick is cautiously optimistic about the possibility of permanent protections.
And there's a lot of reason to be skeptical what the federal and state governments are actually going to follow through on what they say they're going to. This is just the beginning. Time will tell. But it's becoming rapidly apparent that we don't have a lot of time. And it's really great to see the idea that we're going to take bold steps and really address this head on rather than hiding from it.
There is currently no timetable for when legislation could be presented or what the 30 by 30 executive order will look like. And other groups support resource and job development in the region. Iliamna Natives Limited sees projects like the Pebble Mine as an opportunity for their village to grow economically. Northern Dynasty, Pebble's parent company, also submitted an appeal at the end of January to the Army Corps challenging the permit denial. In Dillingham, I'm Tyler Thompson.
The The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta no longer has the highest COVID-19 case rate in Alaska. The region has led the state in case rates for 4 months since October of last year. But as of Tuesday, state data shows the region now has the second highest case rate in the state. It's superseded by the Mat-Su region, which now leads Alaska in the COVID-19 case rate. According to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the YK Delta's case rate is 24 cases per 100,000. That's less than a tenth of what the region's peak case rate was in November, with 300 cases per 100,000 people. State data shows the Mat-Su region has slightly over 34 cases per 100,000 people.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way. 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. What are the human inputs to halibut economics? More after this.
Halibut and black cod buyers and sellers, simplify your sales online from one location at the Seafood Auction. Visit seafoodauction.net.
Who are the users of Pacific halibut and how do they use it? Responses to a stakeholder survey will help yield results for a first-of-its-kind study that aims to characterize the economic contributions of the Pacific halibut fisheries to all regions. The International Pacific Halibut Commission is the first regional group in the world to do such a study, saying understanding the human dimension is part of its mandate for optimum management of the resource. The survey assesses U.S. and Canada halibut users in commercial, sport charter, subsistence, and processing sectors. It measures economic impacts from hook to dinner plate, employment and incomes, household prosperity, and contributions to regional and national economies, known more broadly as multiplier effects. Barbara Hutnizak is IPHC lead economist for the study.
Per dollar of landed fish, how much of the economic activity is generated and how much this translates also to wages, how much this translates to the GDP that encompasses effects on wages but also effects on profits by the businesses that are supported by the fisheries.
The IPH survey also includes spillovers to other areas.
A vessel that is fishing in Alaska, so benefiting from the Alaska-based resource, but this vessel might be, for example, in the winter time, be serviced in, say, Washington State. So in this case, the economic effects will be also in the Washington State.
Hutnizak says responses to the confidential survey will be constantly updated in reports and on a nifty visualization tool. Find links to the IPHC Halibut Survey at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 24th day of February, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 8:16, and it will set again at 6:31 p.m., giving us 10 hours and 15 minutes of glorious daylight. That will be a gain of 4 minutes and 56 seconds, almost 5 minutes a day we're gaining now. Our record high was 54 degrees, set in 1936. Our record low was 0, set in 1975. And it is currently 36 degrees here in Kodiak. And they're calling for more snow this afternoon. It just seems more or less wet right now. High near 38, so we're almost there. Northwest wind 15 miles per hour. They're expecting those winds to increase to 20 and gust as high as 30 miles per hour this afternoon. A slight chance of snow before 1 a.m. tonight, then isolated snow showers between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 32. West winds increasing to 25 to 30 miles per hour after midnight and could gust as high as 40 tonight. For tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, high near 40, west wind to 35 miles per hour, gusting to 45 miles per hour tomorrow. Sunny, warm, and windy tomorrow. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 6:40 p.m. That will be a slight minus tide, minus 2.29 feet, followed by a high tide at 1:14 a.m. of 6.88 feet. And our next low tide will be at tomorrow morning at 6:20 a.m. on the east side of 2.8 feet. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass tides, you have a high tide that just happened at 12:17, a 13.75-foot tide. Your next low tide will be at 7:06 p.m., be minus 0.19 feet. You have a high tide at 1:30 a.m. of 13.46 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 7:12 a.m. and 3.37 feet. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 995 millibar low, 185 nautical miles south of Kodiak City, will move to 170 miles south of Middleton Island and go to 980 millibars on Wednesday afternoon. The low will then exit the Gulf to the east by Thursday afternoon. Resulting weather, not so swell. Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore, gale warning through Thursday. East wind to 25 knots right now, will increase to west 45 knots this afternoon. For north of Dangerous Cape, east 30 knots, becoming northwest this afternoon. Seas to 13 feet and rain. For tonight, west wind to 45 knots, seas to 14 feet. For Thursday night, look for west southwest wind to 25 knots and seas to 12 feet. Over in the Shelikof, Kodiak's west side, gale warning tonight and Thursday, northeast wind to 25 knots, becoming west 30 late tonight, seas to 6 feet. For tonight, west wind to 25 knots, becoming southwest 35 after midnight, seas to 6 feet, building to 12 feet after midnight in the Shelikof tonight. For Thursday, southwest 45 knots, diminishing to 30 knots Thursday afternoon, seas to 16 feet, subsiding to 11 feet tomorrow afternoon in the Shelikof. And for Friday, we're looking at south winds to 20 knots, seas coming down to 4 feet. For inside waters, Chiniak and Marmot Bays, Chiniak Bay, small craft advisory for tonight and Thursday. East 20 right now, we'll go to the northwest this afternoon, seas to 4 feet, coming down to 2 feet this afternoon. For tonight, west winds to 20 or 15 knots, increasing to west 30 knots late this afternoon, gust to 40 knots toward morning. Seas 2 feet, building to 4 feet late. Thursday, west wind to 30 knots, gust to 40 knots, seas to 5 feet in Chiniak Bay. For Marmot Bay, gale warning tonight and Thursday. East wind to 20 knots right now, becoming northwest this afternoon, seas to 7 feet, subsiding to 3 feet this afternoon. For tonight, west wind to 20 knots, increasing to 35 knots late tonight, seas building to 7 feet after midnight tonight in Marmot Bay. For tomorrow, west wind to 40 knots and seas to 8 feet in Marmot Bay. The Alaska Marine Highway's summer schedule is open for booking now. The Marine Highway System has released its 2021 summer schedule. Reservations are available for booking at ferryalaska.com, or you can call 800-642-0066. That's 642-0066, or visit ferry terminal staff throughout the system. Learn to enter and edit Excel content, select cells and ranges, and create and modify basic formulas. The class is called Excel Getting Started Workshop, and the dates are between the 24th and March 3rd. The class fee is $45, and they are happening Wednesdays, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. Any questions, contact Heather at 486-1212. That's 486-1212. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America is holding a free virtual conference on Thursday as part of its Educating America tour to provide information about brain health, caregiving, and more to help Alaska residents affected by Alzheimer's. Learn more or register for free at the Alzheimer's Education Program by visiting www.alz.org fdn.org/tour or call 866-232-8484.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.